politics got to this point because of decades and decades of ordinary, normal, respectable politicians generally, you know, using dog whistles and saying the quiet part quietly instead of the quiet part loudly, doing these things to erode the sense of the public good in America, you know, since the era of neoliberalism, since the Reagan era. So Canada's had much the same thing. We have a center-left that's very sort of milquetoast when it comes to defending these things. But we're going to face a renewed assault on these public goods. It's going to happen probably in a couple of years. And we better be ready for it because, you know, we can't just say patting ourselves on the back that, you know, well, we have a conservative government that's undermining our schools and our health care and privatizing and selling off parts of the universal health care system. Well, but at least they're not being explicitly racist, and at least they're not putting a Muslim ban in, and at least they're not threatening to build a wall or whatever it is. I guess what I'm saying is focusing on these outrages and focusing on the norm breaking and focusing on the things that make Trump so uniquely and disgustingly ugly is a bit of a red herring, because we're going to have to focus on the things that degrade democracy in a much more sort of understated, less visible kind of, you know, Canadian way. And if we're not aware of these things as we come, and if we don't get in the streets and stand up to them immediately, the first chance that they happen, then the next conservative government is going to do a lot for democratic erosion, not necessarily because they do things like lie about election fraud and overturn elections and disenfranchise people, but because they do a kind of softer disenfranchisement, the disenfranchisement that gives people fewer public goods to rally around together and practice democracy on a small-scale local level. That's just as important, if not more important, than the super dramatic stuff we see in the U.S. You know, this stuff in the U.S. wouldn't be happening if it hadn't been for, you know, a good run of several decades of softening up that made Trump possible in the first place.
Searching for something to grasp onto that is more meaningful than Zed or Timbits, and more meaningful than slightly less shitty than America. There was something I read in your book that resonated with me, and it's a complicated idea because it's still kind of in contrast to America, or directly in contrast, but this notion you write about that American politics is a constant struggle over who constitutes the people, we the people, and in Canada, our politics deny that there is such a thing as the people at all, or back to this idea of the real Canadian. On the one hand, I could push against that because I think that it's been very clear to the Canadian establishment for a long time what a real Canadian is. It's male over female, and it's like white over any other color, and it's Protestant over Catholic or any other religion, and it's Anglo over Francophone. And, you know, like there's a very specific idea of who Canada was built by and for. And yet, you know, you write convincingly that there has just always been this tension. There have always been different groups who are saying, no, I'm the real Canadian. And maybe less so than in the States has anyone really been able to, like, solidify that idea to the exclusion of everybody else. You quote John Ralston Saul, who puts it in a way that I hadn't thought about it before, that Canada does have something that is uniquely Canadian and specific to us, which is a non-racial idea of civilization that is non-linear, even non-rational, based on the idea of an inclusive circle that expands and gradually adapts as new people join us. That struck me as true. Like, I don't have a sense that, like, you tell me you're an American, you're a speechwriter in American politics, and now this is your, I'm like, I'm fine with that. You know, I meet people who've just arrived here, and I'm like I have no resistance. I really don't feel any resistance. I don't consider myself more Canadian than they are. And I think that's how a lot of people feel here. Saul writes, and you quote, that this way of thinking about civilization is not Western. It's not a European concept. It comes straight from Aboriginal culture. And that what is unique about the Canadian nation state or Canadian nationalism or even Canadian patriotism is an Indigenous idea that we can constantly expand what we are to include more people. That might sound Pollyanna-ish or idealistic, but it's a pretty good ideal. It's a pretty good mythology, and it doesn't seem like one that's, it might be mythology, but it doesn't seem like a fantasy.
I think you're right to pull that out. I want to give a shout out to Saul's book, A Fair Country, Telling Truths About Canada. It really helped me think about where the aspects of Canadianness that I have come to value have come from, and I think that he is right to point out that the way that these ideas developed and became a part of Canadian political culture was through the encounter between European settlers and Indigenous political thought and Indigenous political ideas that have been incorporated into the story that Canadians tell about themselves in a way that I don't think they've necessarily been incorporated into the American story. Again, that doesn't mean that Canada's history of colonization or settlement is any better or any less awful than the story that, that every settler colony around the world has had to tell. But I think what Saul points out is the way in which there's a counter-narrative and there's a counter-story. I think another person that expresses this idea really well is the historian at University of Toronto, Peter Russell, where he calls Canada a country of incomplete conquests. It's not as if the Canadian settler population has never dreamed of imposing an idea of what it means to be a real Canadian on the rest of the country. It's not as if that's never been a part of our political culture. But because of political realities,
it just didn't succeed.
It just didn't succeed. And that doesn't mean you're better. It just means you've had a little historical luck. You've been worse at it.
Yeah.
And sometimes, like, you take the luck where you can get it.
You go to Quebec and you're like, nothing like this in the rest of North America.
Yeah.
Like, it would get homogenized and stamped out. And it would, you know, like, Louisiana's pretty cool, but it's not Quebec.
Yeah. Canadianness can incorporate many different nations, many different histories, many different founding stories, many different peoples. You know, the U.S. is an extremely diverse country, too. The U.S. has diversity. The U.S. has multiculturalism. The U.S. has multiple histories. But I think that there's this sense in Canada that I have grasped in the time that I've lived here that there isn't just one story, that there are many peoples and nations that trace their history back in completely different and incompatible ways. And somehow we make it work, and somehow that's okay.
All those multiplicities in America still all somehow bow down to America, and they might define that a little bit differently. But we don't here, and that's back to the catch-22, that the distinctiveness is in the lack of nationalism, that our nationalism is that we don't have one. Maybe that's enough?
Well, I think the distinctiveness is in the willingness to not tell this monolithic story about who counts and who doesn't count, who founded the country and who didn't found it, who gets ridden into history and get ridden out of history.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea that, you know, Canadians don't quite worship their founding figures in the same way that Americans do, because one person's founding figure is another person's enemy, is another person's historical villain. And I think that there's a little bit more recognition of the fact that you can't tell a monolithic story, that if you're going to tell a story about this country, it's got to take into account the perspectives of at least, you know, what Saul calls the founding pillars of this country, not just an Anglo story, but an Anglo, a French, indigenous story that are going to be completely incompatible with one another. So I think the way we make it work, the way we have a kind of sense of identity out of the absence of identity, it is not by glossing over the difference, but by saying the stuff that has to hold us together has to be material stuff. It can't be stories about this overwhelming sense of Canadian identity or the heroic Canadian founders that delivered us from the evil British Empire and all these sorts of bad things.
Am I reading you correctly that when we go through this list of deficiencies, that we don't have a foundational myth that everybody feels as strongly about or even knows to the same extent as the Americans, and we don't revere our founding fathers the same way, and we don't have a central idea of who is a real Canadian, that all of those deficiencies are actually strengths?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. So I mentioned that in a lot of ways one of the heroes of the book is W.E.B. Du Bois. He's someone that I work on in my day job as a political theorist. And one of the really interesting ideas he had in his book, Black Reconstruction, in 1935, was the idea of the psychological wage. So how'd he come up with this idea? You know, he was looking around at labor politics in the U.S., and he was looking around at the fact that it seemed as if black workers and white workers had a set of common material interests, and yet most white labor unions in the U.S. were not integrated. They were highly racist. They were segregated. And most white workers and black workers weren't making common cause, even though when, you know, every bit of kind of orthodoxed Marxist or leftist theory said that they should have. And the way Du Bois sort of squared the circle was by saying it's not as if the only wage that matters is the monetary wage you get paid. There's something called a public and a psychological wage. It's getting rewarded by being told that you're the main character, essentially, getting the sort of places of honor in a society. I mean, they could be places of honor like having the nice drinking fountain or sitting at the front of the bus. They can be places of honor like seeing statues of your heroes in public spaces and having your history. Oh, yeah, yeah. Or having your history covered in school textbooks and all that. All these things are a wage. And I think that was the insight there, that there's a trade-off between what you give people in terms of material conditions and what you give people in terms of the immaterial story that you tell them when you make them feel good about being the main character. And the insight there is that if you pay people in stories, in esteem, in exclusivity, in these kinds of things that say you're the main character of this country and these other people aren't, that's real payment. They will accept, as a matter of fact, lower material wages, you know, the kind that come from not teaming up with people that you share interests with. They'll accept those lower wages and they'll accept a worse bargaining position because they want that position of exclusivity. So my point about Canadian politics and how it relates to this idea is not that, you know, these things don't exist in Canada, because of course they do. I feel like I have to say that a lot. But in a country without this one founding figure, without this one founding myth, without this notion of consensus history, where your history of the country might be someone else's history of genocide, all these things mean that it's a lot harder to pay a psychological wage in Canada. It's a lot harder to give people the sort of esteem and reward that comes from saying you're the main characters of this country's history. You're the figures that deserve places of honor and esteem and recognition. So if you can't do that, one, it makes it easier for people to team up and make bonds of solidarity with people that don't look like them or sound like them or even speak the same language as them. And two, if you don't pay people in immaterial means, they're going to want to be paid in material means. They're going to want better wages. They're going to want better working conditions. Maybe they're going to want workplace democracy one day. They're certainly going to want a better safety net and public goods. If you can't pay people with cheap stories about who the main character is, you're going to have to pay them in a better way. So if it's the case that in Canada it's a lot harder to say who the main character of this country is, then that means that's an option that gets taken off the table. That means that there's more room to demand the kind of material things that actually make a measurable difference in people's lives. So I do think that those absences, the kinds of things that make it a lot harder to get a grasp on Canadian identity, at the end of the day really are strengths, because they mean that what people want out of this country is not being celebrated for how wonderful they are and how central they are to the country's story and how they're the real Canadians and how they're the main characters. What they want out of this country is what everyone else wants: dignity, better working conditions, better living conditions, better public goods. The less you have a monolithic story about your country, the more you have to pay people in the real hard currency of material goods.
Well, you know what that sounds like? That sounds like it would be progress. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
That is your Canada Land. You can email me. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land, and our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Additional production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofo. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication's handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Alan S. Hale, Ontario Legislature reporter for Queen's Park Today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Today on the show, the Lioness of Honking, Tamara Leach's new image. Welcome to Shortcuts, Alan, where we talk shit about the news.
We're gonna win, man. We're gonna win.
Calls of support from those who support Chris Barber and Tamara Leach, two prominent leaders of the anti-COVID vaccine mandate protest.
Leach and Barber each accused of mischief, intimidation, and obstruction-related charges after they helped organize the convoy.
Tamara Leach is considered the heart and soul of the movement. She was instrumental in getting on social media and helping the organization raise millions of dollars.
Okay, so Tamara Leach is on trial, as is Barber, but I want to focus on Leach here, and I'm really looking at how she's being covered. It's really interesting. Because, mm-hmm. like, you know, during the convoy, public opinion was so against the occupation of Ottawa that I think even the National Post was like, these nuisance mothers.
Right.
But it's, you know, now that there has been, I don't know, some time has gone by, I've noticed that there is a very different tone taken. And now that she's like done her time or there might, I don't know if there's going to be more, but Tamara Leach was locked up first when she was arrested and then for allegedly violating her bail. So like, look at some of these headlines. This is a CP story that was covered, that was picked up by CTV and many others. How Tamara Leach transformed from spokeswoman to symbol of the Freedom Convoy movement.
Mm-hmm.
She's described as a lioness of the movement. And she's been on Jordan Peterson's podcast.
If we had been there with an agenda to take over Ottawa and overthrow the government, mm-hmm. we could have done it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's quite a thing to say. Because, of course, everybody's comparing this to the other trials that are going on right now, the trials of the January 6th.
Yeah.
Really, the coup attempt and the Proud Boys who are being locked up and the books being thrown at them for trying to overthrow the American government.
Someone who was sentenced to 22 years yesterday, I think.
22 years. And it's so funny how Canada always will create the milder Canadian version of the American thing, because while these Americans are on trial for like coup attempts and sedition and bringing zip ties and who knows what the f*** they were planning,
mm-hmm.
the Canadians are on trial for mischief.
For mischief.
If there's a greater crime in Canada than wearing a scarf with some flair, it's for disturbing the peace. It's for making a noise and making a fuss. Anyhow, I know that a lot of people feel like it was much, much, much more serious than that. And I'm sure if you lived in Ottawa, it was. But this trial is becoming a show trial.
Hmm.
And Leach is having her brand rewritten and her place, you know, in the history of this opposition movement. Here's another piece from The Post. An opinion piece by Carson Jerema. Tamara Leach exposed the incompetence of the Canadian state.
I saw that one too, yeah.
And I'm just reading like into things like the types of photographs they choose of her. She seems proud and defiant, and she's described, you know, making these dramatic entrances and just like what an interesting grandmother and figure she is. And you know, like there really is some cult of personality stuff that's being whipped up by the coverage of Tamara Leach. A lot of people would like to see the heaviest consequences possible.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I wonder what the actual impact of that will be, given that, as was stated on the first day of trial, this is not a trial of their anti-vax political beliefs.
Right.
This is a trial for protesting and crossing the line of what a protest is. This is like, how much noise can you make at a protest? How much opposition to the police is allowed? How much coordination against, like, that is actually what she and Barbara are on trial for.
Right. The convoy's over and the woman is on a criminal trial, and there is a line that has to be walked to not just convict her in the press while her freaking trial is going on. Because mm-hmm. then her lawyers can turn around and try to make the case that she has, like, that there is no possibility for a fair trial. I don't think that's likely to happen. At this point, we're at that point where, you know, things have started and, like, they've tried to get the charges dropped or, like, dismissed.
Yeah.
You know, like, but the media
definitely... She's got a hot shit lawyer.
Yeah. That's true.
It's Lawrence Greenspan.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is a hot ticket lawyer.
I think that the danger is not necessarily that the press is going to so, you know, prejudice everyone that she's going to get off on that technicality. I think that the most dramatic outcome here is that they really overextend and throw the book at her.
Yeah.
And that solidifies the mythology here. I'll always say this, and I don't care how much shit I take for it.
Mm-hmm.
If the outcome of the Occupy movement or the G20 or Wet'suwet'en was to have a maximum application of things like mischief laws.
Yeah.
I would see that as the state coming down against protesting itself and civil disobedience itself. And I think that when you are defending civil disobedience, you have to divorce the cause that was being fought for from the you know, people are like, well, but they crossed the line. That is civil disobedience. That's what protest movements do.
Right.
They make a nuisance of themselves. They cross the line. And then we see how the state interacts with protest by, you know, we are going to overinflate. You didn't hurt anybody. You didn't do X, Y, and Z. You didn't storm the Capitol, but you did break some misdemeanors and you did, you know, coordinate. And even though that is like absolutely on the Ottawa police.
Yeah.
It's on, like, this would have been a one-day thing. We are going to make an example of you to show that this sort of thing won't be tolerated. That's how you create golden gods of protest movements. And, you know, it's interesting because the whole Freedom Convoy movement seems to have kind of dissolved. It certainly doesn't have the same kind of support that it did when they were occupying Ottawa, but they're trying again.
Yeah.
They're planning a new convoy that is all about save the children. They've morphed into this anti-trans kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think they're trying to make a martyr out of her, and I think that it's possible the courts will do them a big favor and maximum application of these laws. Alan, it is your first time joining us here at Shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
We have a thing we do here.
Oh, yeah?
We don't like it when a worthy news story goes ignored.
Oh.
All that work from journalists for a story that people are not paying enough attention to, so we note them duly. Have you a story to duly note?
Well, I think the thing that I'm going to be watching for over the next little while, and I don't think it gets enough attention, is the Indigenous opposition to the Ring of Fire.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work up for the Kenora Daily Miner News back in the day.
So oh, wow.
I've lived up there. I've been to these communities. Like, I've been to Grassy Narrows and stuff. And, like, and that's where I really got into following Indigenous news and politics and stuff. And I don't think people quite appreciate what is going to happen if the province goes ahead and tries to develop the Ring of Fire. And for those who aren't following this, the Ring of Fire is this very large, impressively important-looking mineral deposit up several hundred kilometers north of Thunder Bay. And it's got all these great minerals in it that are going to be very, very necessary for EV batteries and, like, mm-hmm. electrification and stuff.
A lot of money at stake.
There are two First Nations up there named Webequay and Martin Falls, and they are on board with the development of the Ring of Fire. But the problem is the Webequay and Martin Falls are part of a larger group of like nine First Nations called the Mattawak Tribal Council, and the other seven are not on board.
Okay, where can people read about this? This sounds super important.
Okay, if you check out politicstoday.ca, we've got some coverage on this. My publication, Queen's Park Today, and a bunch of our other newsletters that we publish across the country. So you can check that out. It's going to be a thing, and nobody's talking about it. And if things go ahead, there's going to be conflict. And I don't know if anybody's ready.
Duly noted. I got one here. This is a piece in the Halifax Examiner. Holy shit. This is a great little investigation, but these not the Halifax Examiner, but Sobeys. The headline is, "They Don't Let Us. Dollarama Stores Sell Bread Unless There's a Sobeys Nearby." So here's what the Halifax Examiner did. Suzanne Rent went to like four dozen Dollaramas and went and said, okay, do you sell bread? Because the cheapest loaf of bread you can get in many communities is mm-hmm. is the bread that Dollarama sells, Wonder Bread or one of these other, People, like, this is, we're down, what does this have to do with the price of bread? It has everything to do with the price of bread. This is the staple, and people are hunting for ways to save money right now, and they go to Dollarama. And some Dollaramas will sell you a loaf of bread, and others won't. And what they found was that overwhelmingly, the Dollaramas that don't carry bread are the ones near Sobeys.
I see.
Sobeys does not own Dollarama, but they went and they spoke to like employee after employee, and the Dollarama employee said like, oh yeah, we're not allowed to because there's a Sobeys nearby. Then they got multiple people saying that, attributing this to Sobeys. So what's going on here if Sobeys does not? Now, Sobeys actually does own a lot of real estate. They have a company, an affiliated company that owns a lot of real estate, but even when they don't own the real estate, what happens is, and this is sort of inferred, the Examiner did the work to actually like figure out the relationship, the correlation between the Sobeys nearby, and they got the quotes from the employees directly saying it's because there's a Sobeys nearby. But I can tell you what's actually going on, which is a harder thing to report conclusively. What's actually going on is that leases can say anything, and Sobeys has an incredible amount of power as a renter. So even when they're not the landlord, they can make demands and say, we're going to open a Sobeys here, but you have to promise us that nobody's going to compete against us for X, Y, and Z. And they're leaning on the actual landlords, I would very strongly suspect, to have provisions of leases saying you're not going to let Dollarama or anybody else sell bread. And sometimes it's like double the price. So Halifax Examiner did the work. They reported it, and they have agreed to take that story out of their paywall so everybody can get as angry about this as they should be. So go ahead and Google Dollarama Sobeys Halifax Examiner, because like it just seems like we need to keep the pressure up on these grocers constantly.
Duly noted.
And that's Shortcuts for this week. Alan, thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been great.
We are on Twitter at Canada Land. You can email me about this show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. Where can people find you and your work?
Check me out on Twitter, Alan S. Hale, and check out politics.ca. We got newsletters for Queen's Park, for Ottawa, Parliament Hill, and BC and Alberta. If you are interested in following the politics closely, check us out. Try a free trial.
It's well worth your time. This episode is produced by Aviva Lassard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So-Called, syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you for supporting Canada Land.